8. How thoughts think themselves. You know the old saying about Zen meditation, Tibetan meditation, and Vipassana meditation? Well, no, you probably don't. It's a saying that's meant to capture the difference between these three Buddhist contemplative traditions: Vipassana, with its emphasis on mindfulness; Tibetan, which often steers the mind toward visual imagery; and Zen, which sometimes involves pondering those cryptic lines known as koans. Here's the saying: Zen is for poets, Tibetan is for artists, and Vipassana is for psychologists. Like most stereotypes, this one exaggerates contrasts, but it does contain a valid point. Mindfulness meditation, the main vehicle of Vipassana, is a good way to study the human mind. At least, it's a good way to study one human's mind, yours. You sit down, let the dust settle, and then watch your mind work. Strictly speaking, of course, this isn't what psychologists do. Psychology is a science, and sciences, by definition, generate publicly observable data, experimental results that are out there for all to see. In contrast, the things you see when you watch your mind can't be seen by anyone but you. They're not data in the strict sense. So when you're meditating, you're not being an experimental psychologist. If you emerge from a meditative state and declare that the self doesn't exist, that's not scientific evidence that the self doesn't exist. No, if anything, the relationship between science and meditation works the other way around. It's not that meditative observations about your mind validate theories, but more that theories can help validate meditative observations about your mind. If during meditation you see things that are consistent with credible scientific models of how the mind works, that gives you a bit more reason to believe that, indeed, meditation is helping you see the dynamics of your mind clearly. Take the modular model of the mind, for example. There is good scientific reason to take it seriously. Well, if this modular model is truly an accurate picture of the mind, and if Vipassana meditation, insight meditation, indeed gives us insights into the workings of the mind, then you might expect this kind of meditation to give us glimpses of a modular mind at work. I think it does. I think some of the experiences people have during mindfulness meditation make particular sense in light of a modular model of the mind. And I'm not just talking about epic experiences, epiphanies you might have after months of seclusion and meditation, such as the sudden realization that there's no self in there. I'm also talking about experiential steps on the meditative path that might eventually lead to such epiphanies, but are much more common. One of these steps is the most widely shared meditative experience of all: finding it really hard to meditate because your mind refuses to stay in one place. As I've already suggested, to see that your mind is wandering is to see part of what the Buddha meant when he challenged conventional conceptions of the self. If a CEO self existed, then presumably the mind would obey its commands and focus on the breath when told to. Now we're in a position to go further and see that observing your mind in this unruly stage, trying to watch it as the default mode network rages on, can do more than suggest that the conscious you isn't running the show. It can shed light on what is running the show, revealing a picture of the mind strikingly consistent with the modular model. To see what I mean, just follow these four easy steps. 1. Sit down on a cushion. 2. Try to focus on your breath. 3. This step is the easiest. Fail to focus on your breath for very long. 4. Notice what kinds of thoughts are making you fail. These thoughts can vary depending on your age and other factors, but some good examples of common mind wandering would be: 1. Imagining what it would be like to go on a date with the attractive man or woman you met at your workplace, maybe imagining the witty or endearing things you'd say, the way you'd impress him or her, 2. Reflecting on the encounter you had with him or her yesterday and wondering if his or her words signified what you hoped they signified. 3. Reflecting on an encounter in which a rival subtly dissed you. 4. Briefly indulging in a revenge fantasy in which said rival suffers a public embarrassment that reveals to all his or her baseness and unworthiness. 5. Imagining what it's going to be like when you get home and have the beer you so richly deserve after a hard day of fantasizing about the demise of rivals. 6. Reminiscing about that great approach shot you hit on the 18th hole yesterday, and recalling how impressed your playing partners rightly were, not to mention the casually witty remark you made afterward and the laughter it elicited. 7. Worrying about the PowerPoint presentation you've got to give tomorrow. 8. Worrying about your daughter in preschool, or feeling guilty about not having called your aging mother yesterday. 9. Being annoyed that your so-called friend couldn't do you a favor of the sort you routinely do for him or her. 10. Looking forward to the upcoming dinner with another friend at which you can vent about the first friend. And so on. There are three recurring themes here. First, these thoughts involve the past and future, not the present. The one thing you're not doing while having these thoughts is paying attention to what's actually going on in the real world at this moment. Second, all of these thoughts involve you. By default, we think mainly self-referential thoughts. This is unsurprising, given that natural selection designed the brain to focus on our interests, at least our interests as natural selection defined them. Third, most of these thoughts involve other people. This too is unsurprising, given what social animals people are. Indeed, it turns out there's a fair amount of overlap between the default mode network and what brain scans have identified as the theory of mind network, the part of the brain involved in thinking about what other people are thinking. There's also a fourth theme here, a fourth thing that almost all of these mental meanderings have in common. Can you spot it? Hint. What were the previous two chapters of this book about? Exactly. Modules. Though the trains of thought that carry you away from direct experience can take you to lots of different places, pretty much all of those places seem to lie within the province of one of the sort of mental modules I've already described, which is to say, modules that make perfect sense in evolutionary terms. Modules that deal with attracting mates, keeping them, enhancing your status, which can mean derogating rivals, taking care of kin, tending to your friendships, which includes making sure they are reciprocal and that you're not getting exploited, and so on. The one glaring exception, the one thought in the list above that doesn't seem to fit naturally into a major module, is number 5. Looking forward to that beer you so richly deserve. Presumably, evolution didn't build a beer-drinking module into us. But beer, like many other recreational drugs, is an invention that circumvents evolution's logic. It taps directly into the reward center that normally would be activated more arduously by doing things that helped our ancestors spread their genes. When your mind is wandering, it may feel like, well, like your mind is wandering, like it's strolling along the landscape of modules and sampling them, indulging one module for a while, then eventually moving on to another one. But another way to describe it is to say that actually, the different modules are competing for your attention, and when the mind wanders from one module to another, what's actually happening is that the second module has acquired enough strength to wrestle control of your consciousness away from the first module. Far be it from me to insist that you accept one or the other of these ways of looking at mind wandering. For now, I just make 2 points. 1. Psychologists who adhere to the modular model of the mind tend toward the second view. The idea that the conscious you isn't choosing modules so much as being commandeered by modules that have prevailed over competing modules, and thus, as Gazzaniga put it in Chapter 6, won the prize of conscious recognition. 2. If you do go on a Vipassana meditation retreat and slowly, haltingly, get better at focusing on your breath, you will probably lean increasingly toward the second hypothesis. It will seem more and more like your mind isn't wandering within its own terrain so much as being hijacked by intruders. And eventually, these won't seem so much like hijackings as attempted hijackings. Thoughts will arise, but they won't hold your attention for quite so long before you return to your breath. They'll fail to carry you away. The train will pull into the station, and you'll watch it leave without ever getting on it. Actually, I shouldn't have written that last sentence with such authority, as if I often watch with utter detachment whole trains of thought pull into the station and then leave. My typical experience is more like getting on the train and then, after it's left the station and is picking up speed, realizing I don't want to be on it and jumping off. This has been something of a frustration for me. On the one hand, I've gotten reasonably good at viewing my feelings with some objectivity, actually watching them arise as if I were watching some character walk on stage. At least I'm pretty good at this while meditating. In everyday life, my record is more mixed. But I find it harder to view my thoughts with such detachment. To put my problems another way, remember when Gazzaniga said that the thought you're conscious of at any given moment is the thought that comes bubbling up? Well, I've had trouble seeing that bubbling up part. So if you want a vivid description of that, you should listen to someone other than me. Joseph Goldstein, for example. In 1975, Goldstein, along with Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield, co-founded the Insight Meditation Society, where I did my first meditation retreat back in 2003. All three had traveled to Asia as young adults. All three encountered Vipassana teachings there, and all three have become important figures in Western Buddhism, teaching and writing prolifically. Goldstein's seminal 1976 book, The Experience of Insight, makes him a good person to talk to about, well, the experience of insight. Once I pressed him to describe what it's like to watch your thoughts with detachment, or as he prefers to put it, with non-attachment. What it's like to watch your thoughts. One way to get the idea, Goldstein said, is to imagine that every thought that's arising in your mind is coming from the person next to you. How would you be relating to these thoughts then? His point was that you wouldn't be identifying with them. The thought itself is appearing and disappearing like a sound, but being identified with it is something we're adding. I asked, so then in meditation, there can be the sense that thoughts are just kind of coming out of nowhere, so to speak, almost like voices? Yeah, he answered. I'm always happy to help sane people not sound like they're crazy, so I added, although it's not like you're hearing things, literally. Yeah, correct. I liked where this was heading. He seemed to be saying that thoughts which we normally think of as emanating from the conscious self are actually directed toward what we think of as the conscious self, after which we embrace the thoughts as belonging to that self. This, in turn, seemed consistent with the idea that modules generate thoughts outside of consciousness and somehow inject them into consciousness. So I pressed the point. Let me see if I have this right. During meditation, you can begin to see that, whereas you might have thought all your life that you're thinking thoughts, the thing you think of as you is thinking thoughts. It's closer to being the case that the thoughts try to capture you, the thing you think of as you. Right. They come from somewhere in your body, somewhere in your brain. Yes. So far, so good. But then I pressed the point too far for Goldstein's taste. I said, but whatever part of the brain or body you think of as you is more like the captive of the thoughts. The thoughts try to reach out and grab that. That's kind of an interesting way to describe it, and it certainly feels like that. But I would phrase it a little differently. It's just that the thoughts are arising, and there's a strong habit of mind to be identified with them. So it's not so much they have the intent to reach out and capture us, but rather there's this very strong habitual identification. This is how we've lived our lives, and it takes practice to try to break this conditioning, to be mindful of the thought rather than be lost in it. This last point, this idea that identifying with our thoughts is a habit that arose through conditioning, is one I'd quibble with. I think some of our more generic illusions, including perhaps the idea that we generate our thoughts, are pretty deeply built into us by natural selection. Though they're influenced by life experiences, they're on balance closer to being instincts than bad habits, which explains why uprooting them is so hard. But I digress. The essence of Goldstein's qualification I accept. I hadn't meant that thoughts literally try to capture our attention. In fact, the modular model of the mind has led me to attribute less agency to thoughts than some meditation teachers do. Though these teachers are inclined to say that thoughts think themselves, strictly speaking, I'd say modules think thoughts. Or rather, modules generate thoughts, and then if those thoughts prove in some sense stronger than the creations of competing modules, they become thought thoughts, that is, they enter consciousness. Still, you can see how, while observing the mind during meditation, it could seem like thoughts think themselves, because the modules do their work outside of consciousness, so as far as the conscious mind can tell, the thoughts are coming out of nowhere. Anyway, the main point these meditation teachers are making is the same as the upshot of the modular mind model. The conscious self doesn't create thoughts, it receives them. And that reception, it seems, is the part of the process Goldstein had observed with much more objectivity and clarity than I'd been able to muster. The part when the thoughts enter conscious awareness, the part when they bubble up. After conveying to Goldstein that I hadn't meant that thoughts actually harbor a desire to capture our awareness, I asked whether, nonetheless, they sometimes seem like active things, not passive things. In other words, I said, they're actors in your consciousness that you've got to deal with, and you're in the habit of going along with them, but that's not necessary. Correct. And they become a lot less active when we see them for what they are. When we're not pulled into the drama of them. It's sort of like going to the movies. We go to the movies and there's a very absorbing story, and we're pulled into the story, and we feel so many emotions, excited, afraid, in love. And then we sit back and see these are just pixels of light projected on a screen. Everything we thought is happening is not really happening. It's the same way with our thoughts. We get caught up in the story, in the drama of them, forgetting their essentially insubstantial nature. Escaping this drama, seeing your thoughts as passing before you rather than emanating from you, can carry you closer to the not-self experience, to the moment when you see that there is no you in there doing the thinking or doing anything else, that moment when what seems like a metaphysical truth is unveiled. But as we saw in Chapter 5, some people say that the Buddha's original not-self teaching is best seen not as a metaphysical truth, but as a pragmatic strategy. Regardless of whether a self exists, by jettisoning parts of what you think of as yourself, you clarify your view of the world and become a better and happier person. And this pragmatic strategy of not-self, no less than the metaphysical discovery of not-self, would seem to be furthered by the kind of perspective Goldstein was describing. As he put it, when we have that basis of wisdom about the nature of thought, then we have more power to choose, okay, which thoughts are healthy, which thoughts are not so healthy, those we can let go. So far, then, Vipassana meditation looks pretty good in light of the modular model of the mind, and it looks good at two very different stages on the meditative path. That first time on a cushion, when focusing on your breath seems hopeless, thanks to the intrusion of thoughts, and much later on the path, when, like Goldstein, you've acquired the ability to watch thoughts bubble into consciousness, sit there inertly, and then evaporate without carrying your mind away. In the first case, while struggling to focus, you see thoughts capture you, and in the second case, you see them fail to capture you. But in both cases, you realize that the thoughts aren't coming from you, from your conscious self. So both experiences make sense if thoughts are, in fact, propelled into consciousness by modules that are themselves beyond the reach of conscious awareness. In other words, if the modular model is correct, then the view of thoughts afforded us by meditation is truer than the everyday, unreflective view, the view that has thoughts emanating from a CEO self. And this isn't the end of the validation that Vipassana meditation gets from the modular model. Just as the mindful view of thoughts makes sense in light of this model, so does the mindful view of feelings. As we've seen in the modular model, feelings are the things that give a module temporary control of the show. You see someone who inspires feelings of attraction, and suddenly you're in mate acquisition mode, seeking intimacy, being exquisitely considerate, maybe showing off, and in other ways becoming a different person. You see a bitter rival, and the ensuing feelings lead you to seek something different from intimacy, though showing off, depending on the circumstance, may still be in order. It stands to reason that if these feelings of attraction and affection, of rivalrous dislike, didn't get purchase in the first place, the corresponding modules wouldn't seize control. So one of the ideas behind mindfulness meditation, that gaining a kind of critical distance from your feelings can give you more control over which you is you at any given moment, makes perfect sense in light of the modular model of the mind. What fuel propels thoughts? There's a subtler, more fine-grained, and, I admit, more speculative connection between the mindful view of feelings and the modular model of the mind. The first step to seeing it is to pay really close attention while you're meditating. I'm tempted to change that last sentence to read, "Pay really close attention while you're failing to meditate," because the part of meditation I'm talking about is the part when you can't focus on your breath because thoughts keep intruding. But if you're paying close attention to this failure to meditate, then, of course, it isn't a failure to meditate, because paying attention to whatever is happening is mindfulness meditation. Anyway, here's what I've noticed about thoughts that intrude when I'm trying to focus on my breath. They often seem to have feelings attached to them. What's more, their ability to hold my attention, in other words, to keep me enthralled, to keep me from noticing that they're holding my attention, seems to depend on the strength of those feelings. If you don't believe me, just sit down, close your eyes, focus on your breath, and then, once you start failing to focus on your breath, which shouldn't take long, try to focus on the things that are keeping you from focusing on your breath. And I don't mean just focus on whatever thought is distracting you. I mean, see if you can detect some feeling that is linked to the thought that is distracting you. Sometimes this connection between thought and feeling is obvious because the feelings are so strong, even primordial. If you're thinking about sleeping with your neighbor's spouse, or worried that your spouse is sleeping with your neighbor, or fantasizing about giving that neighbor what he or she deserves for sleeping with a neighbor's spouse, then the associated feelings, lust, jealousy, vengeance, are too raw and powerful to overlook. But even many of the less obviously animal, more human, meanderings of mind have feelings pretty obviously associated with them. You reflect on a recent social triumph, maybe a well-received joke you told, and it feels good, so you keep reflecting for a while, and maybe you imagine how you could have followed it up with a witty coda and vow to throw in the coda next time. You're pondering an important deadline you seem likely to miss, and you feel worried, and the worry keeps you fixated on the impending debacle until you come up with a plan of action or convince yourself the deadline's not so important anyway, after which the worry fades and the thought fades with it. Even that most cerebral of mind wanderings, wondering, seems to have feelings that accompany it. If I've sat down to meditate and I find myself indulging my curiosity about something, pondering some puzzle, and I pay close attention, I see that there's something pleasant about the pondering, a kind of continuously doled out carrot that keeps me meandering along the path of the puzzle toward a solution. And if I find that solution, I'm given a culminating burst of satisfaction as a reward. As John Ruskin put it in the 19th century, curiosity is a gift, a capacity of pleasure in knowing. At least, sometimes curiosity feels like that, like a pleasure so refined that you barely notice it. But Samuel Johnson, writing in the 18th century, put a different spin on it. The gratification of curiosity rather frees us from uneasiness than confers pleasure. We are more pained by ignorance than delighted by instruction. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes the quest to know something feels more like an urgent drive, an unsettling thirst. If you're trying to find out whether the stock market, which contains your life savings, continued its recent plunge today, that's different from wondering why the stock market crashed in 1929. If you're trying to find out whether your spouse is sleeping with your neighbor, that's different from wondering whether your neighbor's spouse is sleeping with another neighbor, and more different still, from wondering what makes spouses sleep with neighbors, or for that matter, what makes birds sing, or what makes stars shine, or what makes anything do anything. Whether curiosity is more like a desperate hunger or a delightful lure seems to depend on how directly and urgently relevant it is to our interests as defined by natural selection. The less direct and urgent the connection, the more subtle and pleasant the feeling. But the main point is just that all kinds of curiosity, ranging from a driving, headlong quest to a pleasant stroll along the byways of speculation, do seem to involve feelings. It's no surprise, then, that brain scans are showing that a curious state of mind involves activity in the dopamine system, the system involved in motivation and reward, in desire and pleasure. So this is what I take away from many hours of failing to meditate. I mean, many hours of failing to meditate and occasionally succeeding at mindfully observing this failure. Thoughts that grab my mind and carry it along with them have feelings attached, however subtle those feelings may be. I'm happy to report that this link between feeling and thought has been observed by people whose powers of meditative introspection are way better developed than mine. In June 2015, shortly after sending a rough draft of this book to my editor, I rewarded myself with a 2-week meditation retreat at the Forest Refuge, an appendage of the Insight Meditation Society that is geared toward experienced meditators. The guiding teacher for those 2 weeks was a psychotherapist and former Buddhist monk named Akinkano Mark Weber. One night during a Dharma talk, he said, "Every thought has a propellant, and that propellant is emotional." The word propellant suggests the answer to an important question. When your mind is wandering, when your default mode network is running the show, how does the network decide which module gets to propel its thought into consciousness at any given time? We've already heard references to some kind of competition among modules for dominance, references to a dog-eat-dog world that lies beyond the bounds of awareness. But what determines which dog wins? What makes one dog more powerful than another? Feelings as filing. So far as I can tell, the best candidate for that honor is feelings. Of all the thoughts engaged in subterranean competition at a given moment, maybe the thought that has the strongest level of feeling associated with it is the one that gains entry into consciousness. This is sheer conjecture and could well be wrong, but it would certainly make sense as a way for natural selection to organize the mind. After all, feelings are judgments about how various things relate to an animal's Darwinian interests. So, from natural selection's point of view, feelings would make great labels for thoughts, labels that say things like high priority, medium priority, low priority. If you're a day away from some event that will markedly affect your social status, an important presentation, a big party you're hosting, preparation-related thoughts are high priority, hence high anxiety. But those thoughts are lower priority and the anxiety less acute if you're weeks from the event. If you and your best friend just had a huge argument, figuring out what to do and say about that is a matter of some importance, greater importance than thinking about a casual acquaintance you may have offended, hence the difference between feelings of inner turmoil and feelings of mild concern. In all of these cases, the feelings associated with the thoughts will be commensurate in strength to the importance of the thoughts as natural selection defines importance. And when the default mode takes over, when your mind isn't focused on talking to someone or reading a book or playing a sport or some other immersive task, it is the most important thoughts, the ones labeled with the strongest feelings, that get priority. There will be times, of course, when the most important thought competing for admission to consciousness isn't all that important. Sometimes life is blessedly free of issues that need urgent attention. In that case, the feeling linked to the thought that enters consciousness via your default mode network may not be very strong. But I suspect that if you pay close enough attention, which is a lot easier if you're meditating, you'll pretty much always sense a feeling tone, one that is on balance, positive or negative, associated with a thought that suddenly enters awareness. Because if the thought didn't have some such feeling, it wouldn't have gotten your attention in the first place. Feelings are, among other things, your brain's way of labeling the importance of thoughts. And importance, in natural selection's somewhat crude sense of the term, determines which thoughts enter consciousness. Again, I don't want to suggest that this is a consensus view within psychology. In fact, even if we confine ourselves to psychologists who have embraced a modular model of the mind, somewhat like the one I've described, there probably is no single view on what determines which modules carry the day. But this hypothesis strikes me as the most plausible one on offer. It makes Darwinian sense, and it meshes with the results of meditative introspection. And, though introspection isn't data, it's a legitimate aid in deciding which hypotheses merit further exploration. This particular hypothesis may help explain something about the path of meditative progress. As I mentioned earlier, I find it easier to view my feelings with some measure of detachment than to view my thoughts that way. And I don't think I'm an aberration. Lots of meditators seem to have an easier time with feelings than with thoughts. That would make sense if, indeed, feelings are the glue that makes thoughts stick to your consciousness, that makes you unreflectively take ownership of them. After all, presumably you can't start dissolving that glue, and so can't get any distance from your thoughts until you learn to see it clearly, learn to view feelings with some objectivity. Indeed, in this scenario, you'd have to be good at viewing even very subtle feelings with objectivity before you could view a wide variety of thoughts that way. So it stands to reason that it's quite advanced meditators, like Joseph Goldstein, who would most clearly and vividly see thoughts fail to stick, see them arise and pass away without ever finding purchase in the mind. This hypothesis, that feelings are, among other things, the mind's way of assigning priority labels to thoughts, is consistent with a broad trend in psychology over the past several decades. To quit talking about affective and cognitive processes as if they were in separate compartments of the mind, and recognize how finely intertwined they are. And this trend is yet another case where modern psychology was anticipated by ancient Buddhism. In a famous sutra called The Greater Discourse on the Destruction of Craving, the Buddha says that a mind object, a category that includes thoughts, is just like a taste or a smell. Whether a person is tasting a flavor with the tongue, or smelling an odor with the nose, or cognizing a mind object with the mind, the person lusts after it if it is pleasing and dislikes it if it is unpleasing. As we'll see a few chapters from now, the fine entanglement of affect and cognition helps make sense of one of the crazier-sounding Buddhist propositions, that the things we perceive in the world out there, trees, airplanes, pebbles, don't exist, at least not in the sense that we naturally see them as existing. And as we'll see in the next chapter, this entanglement of affect and cognition can also help us wrestle with a conundrum I alluded to earlier. If the self doesn't exist, then what are the real dynamics of what is commonly called self-control? And what does Buddhism tell us about how to get some of this self-control?